Oops. Okay.
Special pronoun.
Should we start? I heard you chanting. That'd be up there. This is the longer one. Okay. I find that using my breath in meditation can be almost seductive. When I have been doing Buddhist insight meditation, Buddhist insight meditation techniques, breath is often used in the beginning to focus the mind. Now when I do this, it can take me to a very nice state of mind where I feel my body sensations, prana fields, koshas, etc. Even unpleasant feeling coming up and moving through is enjoyable. Is this a useful experience, and if so, please tell me how I can develop this, or am I just experience tripping? That's number one. Number two, since coming here, I've added myself into these meditations, and I think I can have viveka to sit with what is real and what is not. Same question, is this a useful experience? And if so, please let me know how I can develop this. Or is this also experience tripping? Okay. In Vedanta, also we use the breath a lot. The breath is a very powerful tool for absorbing the mind and also taking the mind inward. Like for instance, I think today we did a little bit where you just become aware of your breath and let the mind follow the breath. I don't know if we did so much that, but we did do becoming just aware of the breath and differentiating yourself from the breath. Because the breath is really quite subtle. And by relaxing and following the breath, that actually gives a lot of absorption to the mind. Because the mind and the breath are very connected. So as the breath becomes, I would say softer and softer, and in a sense more and more shallow, almost invisible, the same thing is happening to your mind because of the connection. And just like if your mind is your breath is very agitated, the mind is too, and vice versa. So you can use the breath to really help bring a deep level of shanti to the mind. So it's good for that. Even using different pranayama techniques are very good for quietening the mind. My only question for myself about using pranayama like the breath of fire and some of the more extreme pranayamas that I found that it gave me too much prana, and that and it was very, very pleasing. Also, there's a lot of ananda in that, but that the prana was like almost like a force field, that I felt that I had to somehow let that force field settle down so that then my mind could just resolve into myself. Otherwise, the force field of the prana itself is too much. But that's with extreme, the more extreme types of pranayama, just the regular, more simple types that don't pump the body up with so much energy, I think are more suitable for pre-meditation. You know, before you're starting to really do nitta dhyasana, to have a gentler type of pranayama. Maybe when you're doing yoga, say you're doing the yoga asanas, and then you might have some more of the extreme types of pranayama that are very good for the body and enliven you, and are also very, very pleasing. They give kind of a bliss state also. So there's nothing wrong with that, but when you're trying to go into your own being, that prana, which is part of the maya upadhi really, you don't want it to be overexcited. That's my experience anyway. That's my experience. So you may or may not have that experience that I'm talking about. Something to look for, though. The absorption of the mind is not an absorption into a bliss state. The bliss state is more brought about, even, forget the pranayama now, by shantavrittis. Different levels of shantavritti allow a certain gradients of ananda to an extreme bliss state when the shantavritti is in very, very subtle. It'll reflect in the self or reflect in the mind as bliss. Whereas the self, from its own standpoint, is not a bliss state. Otherwise, behind all of your experiences would be this bliss. Everybody would, when we say ananda, and when we use this word without really spending some time on it, then everybody will just say, where's the ananda? Because you're thinking in terms of a bliss state, you know, well, I must not be experiencing myself now because I don't really experience any ananda right now. You know, so I'm only experiencing myself when I'm experiencing a bliss state. And the problem is the translation of ananda as bliss. You know, we're waiting around for this bliss state. You know, then we have a momentary bliss state. When will I get to be with myself again? When I get the next momentary bliss state. So there's some things that have to be understood there. The ananda, talking about your own being, is, I think a better way of understanding it and to get rid of the bliss, this bliss idea, which is an extreme state, to recognize that which is the most beloved. Because that's not a bliss state, it's not a non-bliss state, it's not an extreme state, it's something which is ever-present, which is your own being, which there's nothing more dear. It is actually the most dear and the most whole and complete. It's when you are truly just yourself without any impediments. And that is a tremendous freedom, and it is... There's another couple of words I could use instead of bliss. That state of being loved. That's, if I say, loving is verbal. Being loved without a lover. Being loved as your own swarupa, as your own nature. And that's what we're always seeking from the world. We're always seeking to be loved, you know. We have a bliss state, but nobody loves me. You know, that's not very appealing. But we want to be loved. We want to feel loved because that's our swarupa. That is our nature. And there's nothing more dear than that. You know, so when we're being with the self, we don't think of, don't translate ananda into a bliss state, because then you'll never be with yourself since it's not a bliss state. Yeah. So I think it helps that when you're doing nididhyasana, you know, and focusing on your own presence, you can even ask yourself, the Buddha asked this question, you know, in my experience right at this moment, what is the most dear to me? What is the most dear? Or you can say like this, why is the self in all of the shastras called ananda, or that which is absolute wholeness, or that which is the most dear, the most beloved? Why do they say that? And you have to say, what about me in my experience right now when I'm just with myself and I'm trying to hone in on, well, what is actually me that's going on and on? You're trying to really hone in on that. In terms experientially at this moment, what is the most dear? Why am I the most dear? What does that mean? And then for me, that was a big realization when I realized that is true. I found myself to be the most dear, that there's nothing more dear than my own being. And it was a huge realization. It got rid of all this ananda idea, the bliss idea, when I realized that there's nothing more really desirable than my own being, you know. So that's important. So the pranayama Are these using your breath is good in that it does absorb the mind, does bring about very effectively a shantavritti. And as long as it's an extreme form of pranayama, then your mind is very available to just gently, the buddhi is very available to just kind of gently focus on your own presence. So it is useful to do, to develop the breath. It's not just experience tripping, it's actually resolve. It brings about a lot of resolution. It's coming here, I've added myself into these meditations that I think I can have Viveka to sit with what is real and what is not. Is this a useful experience? And if so, please let me know. Yeah, it's absolutely useful. That's what we're doing, actually, is in some of the meditations, and some of the meditations are working with imagination and inner child work. That's a level of meditation that we're doing. But the other meditations are geared around being able to differentiate me, my own presence, from the objectifiable experiences, so that my mind, and to notice that I, my being, is present no matter what the experience, and the experience doesn't cover me. So first it's the viveka, to differentiate my own being from all of the objectifiable experiences, the body, the experiences of the body and the mind and the sense organs in the world. So all objectifiable experiences, and to recognize my own presence, which is self-shining and can be differentiated from these experiences without getting rid of the experiences. And some people would think, or some traditions seemingly seem to say, I don't know if they do really, but people believe it anyway. I don't know that traditions actually say this, that you have to annihilate all of the experiences in order to experience yourself. And it's a little bit like the Sankhya Yoga says something like that, but I think that you need to have more depth before that conclusion is made. The reason that the people can come to that conclusion is that the prakriti in the Sankhya, the prakriti is considered absolutely real. It's a real existent entity in its own right. It's not maya. It's not mitya. It's a real existent entity. So, and then there's the purusha. Everyone has their own purusha, which is consciousness. It's very much like the atma, except there's many of them in Sankhya. And so that is self-evident conscious being, very much like the atma. But the prakriti, because of its own real nature, it has to become totally quiet, as though it pranams to the purusha and stays down, so that it is actually not experienced. And so that's the understanding of the Sankhya Yoga that can be problematic, and it can bleed over into how the Vedanta is understood, as though the mithya world has to be, we have to get rid of it. We have to not experience it in order to experience myself. Mm. Like saying, we have to get rid of the desk in order to experience the wood. It's not that way at all. It's not that way. Which is a tremendous, wonderful freedom. Our problem is the ajnana and the self-ignorance that causes all the raga and dveshas, all of our likes and dislikes, our binding desires that just create so much havoc and so much pain. So we're living with a mind that is stressed and it has pain. And it's a mind who's, because of the agitations and the worries and whatnot, doesn't really resonate with my own nature. And I'm living with this body, mind, sense organs that are like alien to who I actually am. Mm. It's very uncomfortable. And so the beauty about the Vedanta is that you get rid of the source of that discomfort. Because you find, you discover that the source of the ananda, the wholeness, that beloved nature that I'm seeking by filling all these desires, is actually hidden in the secrets, actually my own nature. And so when I understand this, then I can be with the world and I can be with my desires. They're all mithya. They don't cover or hurt me in any way. Unless I believe that they're not mithya. that they're real, that desire and that ananda is really out there, and have to go. Then we're back in, you know, there's a little bit of forgetfulness there, and we're back into the suffering. The suffering is useful too. It tells me, oh no, we're not going to go there again. Please save me. It's no fun. It's no fun to have binding desires. It's nice to have desires because it keeps you moving, you know, doing things. But if they're a binding desire, your happiness is dependent. There's not anything, I don't even know what's good about that. It's just filled with pain and stress. And it's totally unnecessary if you have knowledge. How do prayers work? Who hears my prayers? Well, I can say a few things about that I really like and is meaningful to me. First of all, the Shastra itself considers prayer to be a karma, a manasa karma, which is good. Manasa karma means that just like you have a physical action that is an action that has a result in the world, any action that you do, right, it has some sort of result in the world. Because it's a karma. So a manasa karma is also considered an action. It's a thing that you're actually doing. You're praying to Bhagavan for something. And so that prayer acts as a karma that's sent out into the world. It's sent out to Ishwara. Even if you're praying for someone, you're praying for somebody else, that they become well, or, you know, that's, you're actually sending out a karma that is going to have a pala. Karma will have a pala, so it will have a karma pala. So then, believing in prayer, the efficacy of prayer as actually a karma, which will wield a result, then how do you pray? What is an effective way or to pray? And I know I've told this story many times, but some of you, I'm sure, heard it, but that's a question, exactly the question I asked Swamiji. I asked Swamiji, how do you pray? I'm talking to him, how do you, Swamiji, how do you pray? You know, because he has lines of people coming and asking that Swamiji bless them and that pray for whatever situation is there. It's often, you know, my husband is sick, my parents are sick, my child is sick, you know, we don't have enough money to make our payments, you know, or my child is trying to get into school. It's all these normal prayers, these normal worries that they'll always ask Swamiji for help and to pray. Now, often I've got illness. And so I was asking Swamiji, well, how do you actually do that? And he said, well, what it is that they're praying for, say their child is sick, then I imagine that child, I have a vision of that child as well. I see if that, it's more like I see if that vision will come of the child being well, you know, well and happy and all of that. And then if that vision comes, then I trust that vision. Yeah. And it's like that's the prayer and that's the blessing. And then I know that child will be okay. And that's how he feels about it. If that comes, he knows that child will be okay. And he'll say also, to me that seems very risky. But for him, he doesn't look at it that way. He knows that vision comes and he knows the child will be okay. And he'll say, don't worry, child will be fine. And then they have that shraddha. He also has that shraddha. That child will be fine. So then I said, but Swamiji, what if that prayer, that vision doesn't come up of the child being fine, you know? Then he said, well, then, he says, then I tell them that let's see. Let's wait and see. And then he says to himself, to me, you know, I'll work on it. He won't just let it go, but he'll work on it as that prayer. See if that, you know, that somehow those karmas can influence Bhagavan. Or is it cast in stone? Yeah, it's kind of, is that prarabdha cast in stone, or is there any room for any kind of influence? We see that for people who are Jyotishis and astrologers in India also, they see sometimes in the karma that they see there, the prarabdha karma that they see there in the chart, sometimes it's, they have a word for it too, sometimes it's cast in stone, it's very firm. Sometimes, you know, it can be influenced. And they see that in the chart also. So they'll always tell, and that's what Swamiji told me. I don't know that much Jyotish. He knows actually quite a bit. And he's always studied and he's learned, picked up many things from astrologers, and he has a feel for it. And so I know that there's these two types of firmness in reference to what the patterns that you see there. And so is there, can prayers be an influence? Whereas if it just comes, it's not even, it's just Ishwara. Say the prayer just comes, like if the mother asks, will my child be all right? Swamiji prays for it and sees easily, child is fine. It's just Bhagavan. But what if that won't come? Then he'll work on it. See if there can be some grace there. That's what I've understood from him. And so, from what he told me, but then what I have realized that's been fortified so much by what Swamiji has said is that to understand that the psyche itself, you know, which has no boundaries, you know, if you can be praying for somebody around the world and for the psyche that it's not like it's having to travel all the way around the world to get there. It's just there. So this time and space differential is much different. And so the language of the psyche really is imagination. It's images and affect. You know, that's why if you talk to people who are consider themselves psychic and this type of thing, they consider when they're doing that type of work, the channel itself is an emotion. So the channels are like emotional channels, or channels filled with affect. And without that emotion, then somehow it's not communicating or something like that. But if you see just a corollary that all of us are familiar with, when you're going into do deep work in the unconscious, for instance, or the little ones inside, what is enlivening those little ones is emotion, is feeling, is affect. The affect and the emotion go together, you know. You're just having an imagination with your buddhi, but you can also do this. There's not affect there. But when you're down there in the unconscious, there's definitely affect. The unconscious is filled with affect and image. So, then another type of prayer. When Swamiji was sick, I remember the Swamini Tetravidyananda, how many prayers she did doing the production around the Murti, around Dakshinamurti. So throughout the day, and then she got other people to do it also, so there was always, all day long, these particular mantras were being chanted for Swamiji's health, you know. So that's also a type of prayer where there's a certain tapas in it, like say every day, for her every day, how many times, I don't mean,
108. It was,
huh?
108.
Production is around. But then with each production, there were so many chants. So, going around and around and around all day long. There's a tapas there, you know, that brings about some more extra punya. So she would do that all day long, every day. Say, you say to Bhagavan, if you can make my son well, in order for you to make my son well, my daughter well, I'm going to do, you know, 100 malas, you know, of the Mruchinjaya every day. 100 a day. That would take a long time to do that. that's a sankalpa, a tapas that is done to evoke Bhagavan's grace and punya. So there's many different ways to pray. I'll tell you more if I think of something else. The important thing to realize, though, once you realize that the prayer is a karma, there's a prayer, the negative prayer is called a curse. That's also a karma. That's a papa karma. And so you should refrain from wishing some bad, something bad on another person. So.
Not sure. I just thought I heard that question may have asked who am I praying to or something.
Oh, yeah. About sorry that. About the, so that. Might. I like that. This is what I like to say about this one, because to mean something, I think it's beautiful. First of all, who's hearing my prayers? You know, if I say, well, Ishwara is hearing your prayers, then the question is, yeah, but Ishwara is infinite in size. How on earth is he going to hear my little prayer? How is Bhagavan going to hear that, you know? Isn't that impossible? Right? So the example I like to use is if you, first of all, big and small is very relative. It's very relative. Like if you think of a little tiny little ant, a little baby ant, you know, how big are we to that ant? You know, so the whole the idea of size or infinite versus small is totally relative. So now think, if you are the Ishwara of your dream, the Ishwara of your dream, and say the dream covers a lot of territory, you know, and in that dream there are many, many people. In some corner of that dream, there's a few people that are devotees, you know, who are praying to you because the world is in trouble and they feel that you need to come and intervene because you don't know if we're going to make it if you don't come really soon. You know, we need you. That's the prayer. That's a sincere prayer. Okay. Now the question is, do you hear that prayer or not? You, the dreamer. You're the Ishwara of the dream. All these things are happening in the dream. Is the prayer known to you? See, the prayer is known to you because the prayer is part of you. It doesn't matter how big or little it is. It's part of your very fabric, you know? And so you naturally receive that prayer. So I think you have to look at it that way. It's not like there's a little man over there, you know, in Timbuktu. Mm-hmm. And you're over here in this little place way thousands and thousands of miles away, and you're saying a prayer, and this little god over here on top of the mountain, okay, the little god on top of the mountain, can't hear your prayer thousands of miles away. That's not what Bhagavan is. Bhagavan is this is my mind, and whatever goes on it is known to me. So my mind is infinite or it is finite. It doesn't make any difference. It's my mind, and what is going on in my mind is known to me because it's my mind. You know, that's how the mind is. It's your mind, and what goes on it is known to you. Not what's going on in the unconscious. That's only known to you when it comes up into your mind. So just think of the whole infinite creation. It's hard for a finite being to imagine, but the whole infinite creation as my mind, then it is known to me because it's my mind, because it's sattva. And so all of the things that take place in that mind are known in that infinite mind. Infinite mind, you know, we don't usually talk about the total Maya Upadhi as an infinite mind, but we can talk about that way as an illustration. And the reason is because the whole manifest creation, if you're not identified with a given part in that creation, then the sattva itself is reflecting the sattva that runs through the entire creation, and the rajas runs through the entire creation, and namarupa runs through the entire creation on every conceivable level, because that is the material. And that material reflects consciousness. So your mind also, which is encumbered in this physical body with the prana and all of this, but that mind is sattva, and the sattva reflects consciousness. And so that's why the mind and the sense organs are our instruments for knowing, for creating these vrittis. Right? Because they reflect consciousness, then the consciousness allows for whatever is there to be known. Right? And the sattva reflects that consciousness. So whatever content is there enjoys the knownness of the self. You know, it's just manifest in the sattva. So I don't see any difference, except in size, in terms of knownness. Makes sense? Cool. Also, so then if you want to, some people are more comfortable invoking Ishwara in a form like Ganesha, or Krishna, or Saraswati, or Dakshinamurti, or Jnaneshwari, or that form of Bhagawan just, you feel a relationship with Bhagawan in that form. It's the same. It doesn't make any difference at all. You're still praying to Ishwara. And Ishwara is in every form. There is no Ishwara. It doesn't matter what the form is. That is Bhagawan. You know? You could be, you know, taking that flower can be Bhagawan. Because it is. And so, if we're invoking Bhagawan as Ganesha, all of the stories about Ganesha, that, you know, the one who really can help you to remove all the obstructions and that are getting in your way, and so you evoke Bhagawan as Ganesha, or as in our temple, Dakshinamurti temple, we can, especially the men and women, but especially women, the Jnaneshwari, she's the goddess of knowledge, so you can invoke Bhagawan as Jnaneshwari, the goddess of knowledge, you know, who has all wisdom to help you, you know. A beautiful thing in India, both men and women invoke both the masculine and feminine aspects, or, you know, expressions of Ishwara, whether it's Saraswati, or Jnaneshwari, or Lakshmi, or any of the beautiful forms, you know, the feminine side, or Dakshinamurti. You know, I find that I invoke both. It just depends on what I'm doing at the moment. So you can also invoke the same Bhagawan, the same Ishwara, in these different forms. And it's the same thing, that prayer is heard because it takes place in the creation, which reflects awareness. So whether it's directed at a particular form or not, it doesn't make any difference. What clearly marks one as a jnani? How much emotional baggage can be there for the jnani? They say, and Shankara himself says, in chapter 13, very near.
Hello there, Carol.
Now there's a bee on it. There's a bee on it too. Oh, it's Siri. But why did she come now? What did I do?
You're so heard.
The question. She read the question. Oh, okay. Yeah. What are you doing? Go over here. Oops. Okay, never mind. Okay, what was the question? That was weird. Oh, yeah, okay. You know, so in chapter 13, at the very beginning, near the beginning of it, when they're starting to go through the values, the question comes up is who knows whether someone's a jnani or not? And Shankara says, you and your guru knows and you know. And the other people don't necessarily know it not. Or not, if they don't have self-knowledge themselves, they definitely don't know, because they don't know what it means to have self-knowledge. And then, say some of your behavior is not what the other person believes would be the appropriate behavior of a jnani. Then from their standpoint, you're definitely not one, because you act like this. Or you got angry, or you did something, you know. Jnanis don't do that. You know, so we have a list of the jnani's behavior. Actually, we do have that list. There is a, like in chapter 12 of the Gita, the last half of chapter 12, there are several verses that describe the jnani. And then at the end of chapter 2, from verse 52 to the end, there are verses that describe the jnani. And those verses that are a description of the jnani become kind of a sadhana for the mumukshu. And Shankara will say that too, that, you know, these verses, you know, they're just the natural swarupa, the natural swabhava, the natural expression of a jnani. And for the mumukshu, these are the things that we live up to. We take as sadhana. But now, there's this, what we call emotional lag time between your knowledge, actually having knowledge, actually knowing yourself, really, in a very real way, not in kind of an intellectual way, but I mean really in a very grounded way, and also your recognition of Ishvara, also in a very grounded way, so that you actually do have jnana nishtha, you do have that clarity. But there's an emotional lag time where it takes time for that flower, the flower of the psyche, with all of the unconscious material and all of the habitual ways of acting, for that to completely unfold. And so for the person who has knowledge, you know you have knowledge, and you know that these things, you're still working on them, and you have a relationship with them. With those things, those issues that are there that you're dealing with, you have the same kind of relationship you have with other people who are dealing with their issues, which is one of patience. You know, patience and giving the benefit of the doubt and giving people a chance to work through these things, you know, it takes time. And so the same space that you give to other people to grow and to go through all of the things they need to go through for all of the stuff to drop off, you know, we give that to our own issues also. It doesn't cover yourself. You know, it would be like saying, you know, this person out here has problems, and boy, when they have these problems, I just can't be with myself. You know, it's ridiculous. Mm. You know? Mm. But it's the same internally. It's these issues that are there, and they have their own time to work themselves out to where they're no longer an issue for you. They don't disturb you. They might be kind of like, say if you have, there's a big difference between having a big cut on your arm and to having a healed scar. You know, and so you can say your traumas and experiences that you had when you were little can still be open wounds, or they can have healed, but there's still a little scar there that you take with you. So you don't forget the things that have happened to you, but the scar doesn't hurt you, but there's still a memory there. But they're not loaded, you know. And so we all have, for all of us in this room, all of our problems have been worked through. We all have knowledge. All of the problems have been worked through. They're not carrying any heavy baggage with us anymore. There's kind of overwhelming us from time to time. It's all been worked through and the flower has opened. And each one of us is unique. So we have unique experiences. We have a unique personality. You know, we have a unique way of teaching, even though we're all teaching the same vision. We have our own. It's coming through these different upadis, you know. But the baggage that was once very hurtful to us and causes and problems in our relationships in the world, those just become less and less and less significant, you know. And as they become less significant to you, they're less noticeable, and they're less noticeable to other people also. And so you fit more into the person's imagination of what a jnani is like. Yeah. Which has some reality to it too, as long as it doesn't get into psychic stuff. You know, that's all bogus. Not that these psychic things don't exist, but it doesn't have anything to do with having self-knowledge. Yeah. But the things that we would expect of somebody who's enlightened and all of these, if that person has some kindness, you know, that they don't scare you. Not scary. Yeah. There's certain kindness there. And all of us grow in our kindness also. And you're aware of that growth. It's very pleasing. It's very pleasurable to see yourself becoming more humane, more kind, more caring. It's all beautiful. You enjoy it in another person, and you enjoy it in yourself also. It's one of the pullings, you know. So. But that's why they say, you know, that the one who really knows if you're jnani is your guru and yourself, because your teacher has self-knowledge and he knows what, or she knows what it's all about. And can tell if you know or you don't know and what you need to know. It's all kind of, if they know you, then they know that. You know, and they also know along with you what just acts as a pratibandhika, I mean some sort of obstruction. There's still emotional stuff coming up. And, you know, people from besides your teacher and you are not going to think you're jnani because you just simply don't act like one. You know, you just. But that's not necessarily true at all. Yeah. So. And we can't walk around acting like jnanis either. Mm-hmm. That's another huge mess. Could you advise us how to deal with anger during meditation, please? Thank you. Oh yeah, if possible, could you guide us once? Yeah. I think first one good way to deal with anger is to welcome it. That's an important part. The anger is there, you know there's anger there, then to welcome and say, okay, it's okay, you can be with me. And then don't be afraid to feel it. You know? There's no reason not to, say you can say, okay, this emotion is there, you know? And it wants to go somewhere, it wants somebody to help you, it wants to be seen, you know, it wants to be acknowledged somehow, you know? Rather than just repressed. And you can acknowledge all of your emotions. Like, I like that little phrase, it's okay, you can be with me. I'm not afraid to hold those feelings. And then they might have something to say, or you might have something to say to them. Like, if I say, why are you so angry? Tell me what's really going on. I like that one too. Tell me what's really going on. Not what we're projecting out here, but what's really happening. You know. And that's a big relief for your mind, you know. To have room for the whole gamut of emotions. That's not anything to say about acting them out. It's being able to be with them and being in a dialogue, be somebody who understands what has happened to rev up all of these type of feelings and emotions. So being able to be with them and let them talk to you and without pushing them away. I think that's the very best way. It's very healing, actually. Yeah. Because usually when there's anger or nobody wants to be with you. It's kind of like when you need somebody the most, then with those type of emotions, when you could really use somebody to be with you, everybody disappears on you. They don't want to be with you. But you can want to be with you. You know? And then that's really nice. Yeah. When you feel sad and lonely, then everybody runs away. But you have to learn not to run away too. If you don't run away, then you can say, that's all right. Feeling so sad and lonely, you can be with me. Yeah. And when you can give that to yourself, you can give it easily to other people also. You can't give it to other people because you don't want to be with it yourself in yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, but if you can welcome it in yourself, then you can be with other people who are feeling that way. It's not a big deal. But, yeah. we're all doing our best. Also important to understand the truth of that, you know. We're all doing as much as we can. It's a good thing. And it's good enough.
Take care of the wasp that's on the phone.
Oh, thanks.
Why don't you want to go away?
Want to speak with Siri.
Yeah, because it's lit.
One little button. Okay. And swasti, and swasti.
Okay.
Yes.
Jayati, Jayati, Saraswati, Saraswati, Jayati, Jayati, Saraswati, Saraswati. Vidyarupini Saraswati Saraswati Vidyarupini Vidyarupini Saraswati Saraswati Sakala kala Sakala Kalavani Saraswati Saraswati Jayati 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 Saraswati.
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 Saraswati. Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyah Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Parahitah Brahmana Santu Nirbhayah Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinah Sarve Santu Niramayah Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma amritam gamaya, om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate, purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vashishyate, Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.